as you mentioned, the polarity of your compass that points towards the north is a north polarity magnet. And since opposites attract, it has to be pointing to a south magnetic pole, not a north magnetic pole. So even though if you were to Google a north magnetic pole, it would give you some coordinates on the near Alaska. It moves around a little bit, and they do call it the northern magnetic pole. But as an actual magnetic pole, it's the south pole. So I thought that might either amuse people or annoy people, or both.
So we're talking about north polarity of the magnetic vector, which is near Alaska, so to speak, or actually it's in northern Canada, I think. And the magnetic, what's called North Pole, I think it moves by numbers like 30 miles per year. The Earth's rotation polarity moves by inches per year, but the Earth's magnetism, I think it moves miles per year, and from time to time it threatens to reverse. The Earth's magnetic polarity has reversed a couple of times in the so-called recent geologic history of the Earth. K2RIW.
Yes, indeed, Dick. It's a very complicated thing. It deals with some concepts called magnetohydrodynamics. The fact is that there is a solid iron core at the very center of the Earth, and then there's a large area of molten iron around it, and the spin of the Earth produces this magnetic field in an odd sort of way. If you remember your Wilmhurst machine, doesn't necessarily, one of them doesn't always do positive and the other one always negative. There's no kind of orientation for that physically. What it tends to do is pick up random qualities of charge and amplify them. And so there are eddy streams going on within the liquid iron that's spinning that kind of amplifies random magnetization. And that's why you can either get the northern polarity magnetic pole towards the north or towards the south. It can flip, and it can move around. And the strange thing is you tend to think that it's symmetrical, but it's not. The northern magnetic pole, which is a real south pole, moves a heck of a lot more, apparently, than the southern magnetic pole. It's a little bit more fixed in the south than it is in the north. So that's counterintuitive as well.
But darn Earth is complicated. In the case of a Wilmhurst machine, there's almost no magnetism there. That's a purely electrostatic machine. And if by various means you make the right-hand probe positive when you start up the machine, it'll become very positive, and vice versa. I sometimes bias it by bringing it near a cathode ray tube television set, which has always got a little bit of voltage on the glass, if you know what I mean, is one of the ways. Occasionally, particularly on a damp day, the Wilmhurst machine is hard to start. Once you get it going, it's happy. But there are times when it's hard to start, except on a dry day. I remember once in the wintertime, it was very dry, and I brought it outside, and it worked like a charm. I brought it inside where it was still cold from outside, and moisture formed on it, and it wouldn't work. It's very moisture sensitive, a Wilmhurst machine. But a good Wilmhurst machine, properly tuned, can make well above 20,000 and sometimes close to 200,000 volts between those two probes. When you got it tuned just right, I can make it jump a 5.5-inch gap, my Wilmhurst machine. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, there's a very tricky, that's another non-intuitive sort of thing. Let me let the repeater rest a little bit, and I'll be right back. Anyway, getting back to the Wilmhurst machine, I love it. It's a great toy. I first saw it recently. I kind of knew about it back in the good old days, but I saw it somewhat recently in Silent Key John, KC2GBH. In his QRZ page, he had a picture of a bunch of his Shack equipment and a Wilmhurst machine. And it's kind of amazing how they work, that they just amplify electrical charge. So if you induce a little electrical charge in one part of it, it'll just kind of amplify it. And also, you sort of think counterintuitively that if you arrange it for the positive electrode to be at a right angle to the negative, it'll make longer spots. But it's actually and put the negative in the middle at the right angle. But it's the exact opposite. The actual positive electrode is going to produce a wider spark if you arrange them at right angles with the positive electrode in the middle of the other one going at a right angle.
Yeah, John has that Wim Hof machine because I talked him into buying it. I also shipped him pieces of styrofoam, which are very handy for putting things on it to put in close and the probes. What's going on is the positive probe contains protons, so to speak, and they are very low in mobility. The negative probe is high on electrons, and they're very high in mobility. And when you make the negative electrode aim at right angles to the positive rod, so to speak, you get a whole bunch of sizzling, but no real good sparks. When the positive electrode is at right angles to the middle of the negative one, you get the healthiest spark because it'll hold off. It doesn't do sizzling. It'll hold off until it gets to a nice high voltage, and then you get a nice big spark. So you get a huge difference as to which probe you aim toward the middle of the other probe, and that's what you were discovering. And John and I had quite a few discussions on that from time to time. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Gosh, this repeater makes so many noises in and of itself. Well, it's probably even worse than the momentum of a proton because atmosphere doesn't really contain too much in the way of hydrogen, so it couldn't be too much ionized hydrogen. Most of it's oxygen and nitrogen, so it's ionized oxygen nuclei or nitrogen nuclei, which is much heavier than a simple proton. So, yeah, it's a matter of the momentum of what's going on. Electrons have a negligible momentum. Oxygen and nitrogen nuclei have a significant one. But it's sort of, you know, again, I don't know if it's terribly intuitive. If you ask the average person if that's happened, they would kind of scratch their head and imagine it. But it's a great toy. I've used it probably too often because it doesn't have a lot of practical value, but then, you know, most things in life aren't necessarily practical if they're just beautiful things. And, you know, it's a nice little gizmo. I'm glad that I purchased it.
So I think you're saying you purchased it from John's his retirement or his legacy. You got it from John's QTH. Is that true?
W2GTT.
W2GTT.
Yeah, I was just wondering, could you use it for dielectric testing?
I'm not sure if you could. Well, I mean, to a degree, you couldn't get quantitative results. You could get some kind of qualitative results. But just to answer you, Dick, no, I actually bought it before John passed away. Matter of fact, we talked about it on the radio, and he was slightly disappointed that my Wilm Hof machine had a bigger diameter than his Wilm Hof machine. I did purchase his Bird watt meter when he passed away. Because I really, you know, it's almost like you're not a ham unless you have a Bird watt meter. And it really struck a chord that I would have John's old Bird watt meter. He probably had about six or seven. I think he had four or five Kenwood 2000s, TS-2000s. But I had one of his Bird watt meters. But this Wilm Hof machine, I think I got it off of Amazon. It was the nicest looking one I could find.
And I think you said yours is larger in diameter, which means that it does produce a higher voltage. By way of how big a gap it will jump, gives you a reasonable measurement of how many volts. Therefore, I say you could use it for dielectric strength testing once you know roughly how many volts it makes. And there's various ways you can measure that voltage with an electrostatic voltmeter. I've got one of these electrostatic voltmeters, a very rare item, by the way. So you could use it for electrostatic testing. Whiskey 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. You've got it, Gordon, K2RIW.
I'm not in a great area, but I just wanted to roll that question out there. So if you can measure the voltage, then yeah, I would think you could at least check to see if dielectric capability of a material would be sufficient for an application, as long as you don't heat it up. All right, I'll let it go. I'm going to be near home, and I'm going to get worse. But happy New Year, and hope everybody had a Merry Christmas, and continuing to have a wonderful Hanukkah. W2TDT.
Now, you sounded good that time. We had a solid copy on you, Gordon. By way of measuring the gap it will jump for the particular way you get the machine set today, you can make a 20% accuracy, 20% error prediction as to how many volts, because the dielectric strength of air is pretty well known, 30,000 volts per inch. I think it's 30,000 volts per inch, or is it per centimeter? I think it's per inch. And so you can estimate how many volts you've got and therefore measure the dielectric strength of things. It doesn't create any heating. It can't produce any real wattage of power, but it can produce some very nice high voltages. And there's various kinds of electrostatic toys you can buy that you can put in front of the machine. One of them will make a snowstorm inside of a jar. That one's a lot of fun to watch. The snow. Okay, we haven't been letting the machine drop all the way. Yeah, the somebody, I can't remember the man's name, Eldridge's Snowstorm, or something like that's the name of it. It's a lot of fun to make that snowstorm. So, if we follow Lou's suggestion and let the machine drop in between every other transmission and maybe every transmission, maybe we can stop it from dropping out. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, if you want me to give it a try, I've given you my two puzzles for the night. The rest are just the stories. So I don't know if you want me to attempt this this feat. It may work. It may not work. I don't know.
If we do enough dropping out, I think you can give us a couple of the stories, Roy, because some of them are pretty good. Go ahead.
Okay, we'll give it a try. Social media and news headlines are ablaze with talk of the red giant star Betelgeuse, since astronomers noted that it's growing fainter than ever before. Yes, the star is nearing the end of its life, and that end will likely be rather explosive. But is Betelgeuse about to go supernova? The answer is complicated, and in short, probably not. The dimming could well be the result of the star's typical variable behavior. Betelgeuse forms the top left corner of the constellation Orion and is among the brightest and most recognizable stars in the sky. It's also massive, weighing perhaps 20 times the mass of the Sun. Its radius is around 900 times that of the Sun. If it were in our own solar system, it would engulf the closest four planets. The star is relatively young at less than 10 million years old, but its color demonstrates that it's far along in its life. Given its large mass, astronomers expect the star will die in a fiery supernova. It's exciting to imagine what a nearby supernova would look like. Betelgeuse might collapse, shining brighter than our moon in the sky for weeks or more, but don't expect such an event too soon. Let me drop. Okay. Astronomers have been talking about the star growing dimmer or fainting in science speak. Betelgeuse already varies in brightness from a magnitude of 0.0, that's about the brightness of the fourth brightest star in the sky, Arcturus, to a magnitude of 1.3, which is slightly brighter than the planet Mars. But the fainting that began in October was quick, and the star is no longer in the top 10 brightest stars in our sky. In fact, the star is now dimmer than ever observed before. dying and fainting, trying the fainting to the impending supernova is an exciting idea, but there are plenty of other options to consider first. EarthSky.org reports that chemical processes on the star's surface might change its brightness. So too might gas or dust obscuring it. Perhaps multiple cycles of dimming have all aligned. Material moving around the star's surface could also be behind the dimming, according to National Geographic. Of course, it would be amazing if Betelgeuse went supernova, and no, it would not harm us here on Earth. But we're going to be appropriately skeptical. There are other, more mundane possibilities that astronomers must first rule out before settling on the most spectacular one. And we already know that dimming and brightening is simply part of Betelgeuse's regular behavior. Astronomers do expect the star to go full supernova in perhaps the next 100,000 years. But the current dim spell doesn't mean that a supernova is imminent. As much as I love a good fireworks show, don't expect too much from Betelgeuse for now. Until Betelgeuse goes, there are plenty of other stars in the sky. Some astronomers have noted that Eta Carinae may be our best bet for the next big light show. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. WS2N. Yes, Paul.
I think that's about 1,000 light years away, so they said it wouldn't affect us. Is that true? Yeah, I mean, you know, that it sounds far, but I think if that thing goes supernova, you know, we might wind up with X-rays or gamma rays or something.
It might be far enough away that we wouldn't have significance of that. But if it does go supernova, I'm guessing you're going to be able to see its brightness in the daytime. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's about 640 light years away. So if it blew up right now, no one would kind of know about it for another 640 years. And as far as we understand the nature of that star, it'll give off a lot of light, but probably not any kind of serious amount of radiation that will reach us here on the surface of Earth. It'll be like a second moon in the sky. Okay, on with the next question, next story. Engineers at MIT have come up with a new approach to medical imaging that is both non-invasive and hands off the patient. Using lasers, they can peer beneath the surface of the skin without any physical contact required, improving upon the limitations of equipment like ultrasound machines. There's a myriad of techniques and machines that physicians and medical professionals can use to look inside the human body before having to resort to invasive exploratory surgery. But they each have their pros and cons. Repeated exposures to X-ray machines can result in unhealthy dosages of radiation, while computed tomography, or CT scans, require patients to lie motionless in a claustrophobic, loud, and generally unpleasant metal tube. Ultrasound is one of the simplest approaches, but even it has limitations, as a sound wave emitting wand needs to be physically pressed against the skin for it to work. That can sometimes rule it out as an option, such as with patients recovering from severe burns. In a paper published recently in the journal Light Science and Applications, the engineers at MIT explained how they developed a system that mimics the capabilities of an ultrasound machine, but using lasers that, at least in its current form, work from a distance as far as half a meter away from a patient. Lasers can be as innocuous as a pointer and projects a red dot on a slideshow, or as dangerous as a tattoo removal gun that can fry a digital camera. The MIT research has settled on a wavelength of 1,550 nanometers, which is readily absorbed by water, but is also safe for human skin and eyes. Let me drop for a sec. Since skin is mostly made up of water, when the laser is targeted at a patient, it's absorbed and gently heats up, which in turn causes the water in the skin to expand. By pulsing the laser beam, that expansion and contraction of the water in the skin can be controlled, creating a steady oscillation that creates sound waves, just like the surface of a speaker does in response to electrical signals. Those sound waves then propagate through the body the same way that sound waves from an ultrasound machine wand do. But instead of using a microphone to detect how those sound waves bounce off the body's internals, the MIT engineers employed a second laser that serves as a sensitive motion detector. As the sound waves interact with different types of tissue as they travel into the body, they bounce back with different intensities and frequencies that create vibrations on the surface of the skin that can be detected and measured. Those measurements are then heavily processed through software and algorithms, which produces an image of what lies beneath. As with more traditional ultrasound techniques, a laser-based system is currently limited to imaging a patient to a depth of about 6 centimeters below the surface of the skin. And as some of the earlier tests with metal objects embedded in gelatin mold reveal, the fidelity of the laser doesn't quite match the image capability of existing ultrasound machines. However, the researchers went on to test their approach using animal tissue and eventually human subjects and found that the lasers were able to distinguish subtle features, such as the differences between bone, fat deposits, and muscle. Let me drop for a sec. The researchers are looking to further improve the capabilities of this system, including boosting its resolution so that even finer tissue features can be imaged, and miniaturizing the hardware so that it could one day be used as a portable imaging solution. And because there is no physical contact involved, there's the potential for laser-based ultrasounds to be administered without the need for a highly trained technician to wield the wand, paving the way for them to be performed at home or as part of a daily checkup routine. At the same time, the new technique raises some concerns, as it means a person could theoretically be physically examined without any actual physical interactions and potentially without their knowledge. The idea of walking through a laser-filled tunnel that analyzes your body inside and out sounds like science fiction turned to fact. But as this technique is further improved and refined, there is seemingly the potential for it to become the way for someone to assess your health without you even knowing about it. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Have you seen any of the pictures, the difference between one or another? This is WS2N.
No, I don't think I have. Let me click on my little link here and see if that page actually has any illustrations in it. One sec. Well, actually, yes, indeed. It's been a week or so since I read this thing. It actually has some samples of regular sonography and this new technology. So you'll be able to, once I put the link up and you click on it, you'll see what the different images look like. The traditional ultrasound technique images look a heck of a lot better, but, you know, time will tell if they're able to fine-tune this technology.
Very good. What's the objection to the other system, you know, the existing system? Just the idea that somebody's pushing against you to get a reading? In other words, that bit of uncomfort, you know, somebody being uncomfortable about, you know, that particular, you know, somebody grabs you by the side or pushes too hard, or is that the problem? You know, what are they gaining by this?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's principally what they mention is burn victims have very sensitive surfaces. You can't rub a wand across them to use for this purpose. But they also suggest that it will be easier to implement on an amateur level, if you will, that you'll be able to build equipment that they could take home and they could use it at home rather than have a trained technician who knows exactly how to move the wand. If you don't move the wand right, you don't really get much useful information. If you've ever seen videos where they simulate it, it's rather funny sometimes where the wand is totally in the wrong place, but they put up a fake image on the test equipment screen. So they're going to dumb it down by not requiring a technician, and they're also going to be able to use it for people who have burn and other problems with their skin.
Okay, thanks for the answer. Okay, that really makes sense. Yeah, okay, yeah, burn victims, you can't go near. Very good.
Okay, very good. Before I start the next little story, I also have something I want to remind people. Ham Radio University is going to be next Saturday. Me and Andy, WA2CDL, will be doing a talk on test equipment. And it's going to be a two-hour one. We did one last year for an hour. And we were able to wiggle another hour into it because we had a lot more stuff to cover. And people said they enjoyed it, and I hope they enjoy it this coming Saturday. So if everyone, if you're in the neighborhood, drop in and take in the show and say hello to me and Andy. I just wanted to remind people of the Ham Radio University next Saturday. I'll be there, and we will have a nice little two-hour session on test equipment. Let me drop for a sec. On to the next. Residents in northern Montana reported a string of strange lights dotting the sky. What looked like UFOs from an alien invasion has turned out to be another consequence of SpaceX's Starlink satellite constellation. SpaceX launched 60 satellites into orbit back in May and another 60 in November 11th as part of the Starlink satellite constellation meant to increase satellite internet access. But the reflective satellites are also producing bright trains of lights across the sky, stoking UFO fears for those unaware of the satellites and distracting the astronomers. The most recent sighting of a train of starlight satellites occurred over the cities of Browning, Rocky Boy, and Lodgepole in Montana, where residents shared sightings with local news outlets. University of Maryland computer scientist Jen Golbeck pointed out in a tweet that the train could also have been visible in Illinois, Iowa, and Michigan this past week. A Starlink constellation launched in May stoked a similar wave of UFO sightings in Europe. But perhaps more worrisome than a rash of UFO reports, these sightings are distracting astronomers. As we talked about a few weeks ago, earlier the satellites appeared in the images taken by astronomers operating the dark energy camera at the Cerro Tololo Observatory in Chile. Approximately 1 in 40 exposures captured the satellite train. Each train of the satellite eventually breaks up as they settle into each individual satellite as they settle into unique orbits. Let me drop for a second. Astronomers have reported that at present the satellites are more of an annoyance than a real problem, but may become more noticeable as the number of satellite constellations increases. The batch launched this year are just the first of a project that may lead to 12,000 or more satellites deployed by 2025, and SpaceX announced that they'd launch another 60 in early 2020. This past summer, the International Astronomical Union issued a statement urging satellite constellation producers to work with the astronomy community to understand the potential impacts of these satellites and to work with regulatory agencies to produce rules governing the satellites to minimize these impacts. For what it's worth, SpaceX CEO Elon Musk tweeted that he directed his team to work on reducing the reflectivity of the satellites, but scientists who spoke with the National Geographic said that they'd prefer if these conversations occurred before the satellite launch. Fixes like simply reducing the reflectivity might not even work for our most sensitive telescopes, according to the New York Times. And the Starlink constellation of satellites could lead to competitors further polluting the night sky with satellite constellations of their own, injecting even more space junk into orbit that we'll eventually have to deal with. All that is to say, if you see a streak of lights flashing across the sky, it's probably not aliens, and it's probably frustrating astronomers around the world. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Bravo Zulu. AC2 Bravo Zulu, Doctor.
Yeah, Rich, I'll pick you up. I just have to wait for the repeater to go completely quiet. Otherwise, it'll time us out.
OK, Okay, I just wondered, when the clutter gets to be too much, what do they have to do? Go up there and retrieve these to be solution on?
It's my hope that they have some mechanism to just let them drop out of the sky and burn out before they reach the Earth. Paul might have a little bit more information on if they have any recovery scheme for these satellites.
Yeah, I do. I'll let it drop. Yeah, each 500-pound satellite is equipped with a whole ion thruster. And it's designed to maneuver in space, and then at the end of life, they're also designed to rotate. And the way they rotate is they have momentum wheels inside, and they'll rotate the satellite, and then the ion engine will fire, and it'll slow itself down and deorbit. If they see a problem with the satellite, that's the plan on doing something like that. So, and they're about 400 miles up. Back to you, Roy.
I don't know. Personally, I wonder how he's going to get 12,000 of them up there. I think governments are going to kind of get tired of him bringing more and more of them up into orbit. But who knows? But, we're going to get probably a lot more of these UFO reports as time goes on.
He just put a request in for another 30,000 after the 12,000. This is bizarre. And then you've got Amazon, they want to do the same thing. And then there's another one, another company. I think they're having money problems, so they might not do it. But you're going to have two or three of these companies doing the same thing with thousands of satellites. It's really bizarre. Maybe they should paint the satellites with Vanta, that Vanta stuff you talked about a year or so ago, that paint that you put it on and it doesn't reflect any light. Maybe that would help, Roy.
It probably would help to a degree, but I mean, after a while, I realize that space is a big thing and orbiting in space is a big surface area, but still, there's only so many satellites that you can stud along the way that you're not going to get collisions and stuff. I don't know. This strikes me as a problem waiting to occur down the road.
Yeah, they do have avoidance. They see another satellite coming. They know to move away from one another. These are all, this is all in the software. I hope the software is right.
Well, but I assume that's for slow speed devices. If you have a rocket that's trying to clear Earth's orbit, I don't know if the equipment can move out of the way fast enough.
That's a different story. Oh, yeah, you're talking about, you do a launch and hope you're not off by, a little quarter of a mile or something. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, the first rocket collision that's due to this mess, I think Elon Musk's company is going to kind of go under. Because those things are expensive. If you've set up a rocket and launch it and you need to put stuff into high orbit and it bangs up against a couple of his little piddling satellites and causes it damage and failure. Hundreds of millions of dollars. They're going to want their money back from someone.
James Webb Space Telescope. It's up to $10 billion. When they launch that in 2 years, see what happens if that thing hits one.
I certainly hope the telescope is blessed. It's been delayed enough. It doesn't need any more disasters. Unfortunately, I don't know. It's just I at this point, I think we should talk to Elon Musk and see if he wouldn't rather build a Dyson sphere. That's a very theoretical construct, which is basically a sphere that's one astronomical unit from the sun, totally enclosing the surface area. That should take them a few billion years to do. Okay, on to the next. We've talked in the past about how home DNA kits are entertaining and is useful as your average astrology reading. Recently, the Pentagon has issued a warning to military personnel in an internal memo. The memo, which was initially obtained by Yahoo News, notes that mail-in consumer DNA kits like 23andMe or Ancestry could pose a security risk. Quote, exposing sensitive genetic information to outside parties poses personal operational risk to service members, end quote. The memo reads, those direct-to-consumer genetic tests are largely unregulated and could expose personnel and genetic information and potentially create unintended security consequences and increased risk to the joint force and mission. The memo also alleges that some consumer DNA kit companies have been targeting service members with discounts. The existence of the December 20th memo was confirmed to the New York Times by a Pentagon spokesperson. Besides potential security risks, which the memo didn't get into, consumer genetic tests have higher stakes for military personnel. The laws that protect civilian workers from health insurers and employers from genetic discrimination don't apply to military members who must report medical issues. Meaning, if a service member finds out that they are predisposed to a condition, it could have a negative impact on their future career prospects. Since consumer DNA kits don't have the best reputation when it comes to unintended results and accuracy in predicting medical risks, accidentally crippling your career based on untrustworthy results sounds like a bad bet. The Pentagon clarified to the Times, however, that the military personnel aren't banned from genetic testing. It would just prefer service members to rely on licensed professionals and not mail-in kits. Let me drop for a sec. In general, however, you don't have to be a military member to be wary of consumer DNA kits. For instance, even though these companies claim your information won't be sold to third parties without consent, it doesn't mean your DNA is private once you spit in that tube. The information you give up can be used by law enforcement agencies to solve crimes, as in the case of the Golden State Killer in 2018. Also, these DNA databases have been found to be disturbingly easy to hack by bad actors. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. China, this past Friday, said that its Baidu navigation satellite system that emulates the U.S. global positioning system will be complete with a launch of its final two satellites in the first half of next year. Project director Ran Quanqi told reporters that the core of the positioning system was completed this month with the launch of additional satellites, bringing its total constellation up to 24. This was up from 19 the year before, making it one of the rising space power, China's most complex projects. Iran described the system as a rear news conference, says having high performance indicators, new technology systems, high localization, mass production networking, and a wide range of users. Before June 2020, he said, we plan to launch two more satellites into geostationary orbit, and the Baidu 3 system will be fully completed, Iran said. Let me drop for a sec. The latest launches mark the third iteration of Baidu, meaning Big Dipper, the first of which was decommissioned in 2012. Future plans call for a smarter, more accessible, and more integrated system with Baidu at its core to come online by 2035, Rand said. Quote, as a major space infrastructure for China to provide public service to the world, the Baidu system will always adhere to the development concepts of China's Baidu, the world's Baidu, and the first-class Baidu, serving the world and benefiting mankind, end quote, Ran said. China's space program has developed rapidly along all lines over the past two decades and developing independent high tech technologies and even dominating in fields such as 5G data processing is a major government priority. In 2003, China became just the third country to independently launch a manned space mission and has since constructed an experimental space station and sent up a pair of rovers to the surface of the moon. Future plans call for the fully functioning permanent space station, a mission to Mars, and a possible crewed flight to the moon. Let me drop those questions or comments. This is Ace.
W1.
Yes, Paul.
I'm getting used to this. Lou's advice worked out. Very good. Constellation system by China, of course, we have it. The European Space Agency has been doing this for quite a few years now, called the Galileo system. It's going to be at least three systems independent that I know of. But, you know, these are more satellites. You know, we have probably about 24 operational, and then you have a couple of them that are backups, and then you're going to have the same with Baidu and the same with Galileo. So it's just another group of satellites to add to the, you know, thousands of other ones, you know. Well, these at least are in higher orbit. These are like 11,000 miles up, you know, half the distance between geosynchronous and us. So, but it's still a lot of satellites. And I don't think there's a recovery system for these. I don't know if they burn out, where they go. You know, I don't know if they can't make it to the graveyard, and I don't think they could deorbit. Back to you, Roy.
Well, if I had a choice between Elon Musk's 12,000 or these guys' 24, I think I'd probably pick the 24. And I would assume that a lot of this stuff is slowly going to decay back towards Mother Earth. I don't think it's a stable, particularly stable long-term orbit. So that might not be that much of a long-term problem, although it's still more stuff up there in the sky.
Okay, very good. That glove is still flying around from Gemini 4. That never came back.
Well, probably the lighter things are, the longer they take for the orbit to decay.
I know, but it's altitude, too. You know, it's a rarefied gas, but, you know, if the higher you go up, you have less. You know, if you're 200 miles up, you're going to have a lot of, you know, even so it doesn't seem like it when you're there, you're going to have a lot of atoms in the way slowing you down. I think I picked it up too quick. I'm going to turn it back to you.
Well, I mean, for the most part, things are not usually stable in orbit. They'll either spiral in or they'll spiral out, and when they're close enough to the atmosphere, even though it has a lot less pressure and density, it still has some, so that friction is going to slow it down. And when you slow down an orbiting object, it falls to Earth. If you speed it up somehow, it'll fly away at a higher orbit. But if you slow it down, it's just how quickly you slow it down. If you slow it down very, very slowly, it takes a very long time for it to land. Okay, on to the next. Physicists from across Europe have outlined plans to build a new type of accelerator facility based on something called plasma wake fields, which we've talked about before. Named the European Plasma Research Accelerator with Excellence in Applications. These guys love acronyms. This one's called Eupraxia. The project envisages building high-energy plasma devices on one or possibly two sites in Europe. Its aim is to show how the size and cost of accelerator facilities, particularly those relevant to industry, could be radically reduced compared to ones employing conventional radio frequency technology. Plasma wake field accelerators exploit the extremely high electric field gradients that are created when laser pulses or charged particles travel at high speeds through plasma. Those gradients, generated by a sharp separation of electrons and ions in a pulse's wake, can be used to accelerate electrons traveling behind the pulses to very high energies over very short distances. Researchers have already demonstrated the principle of wake field acceleration in the lab, having achieved gradients as high as 100 gigavolts, electron volts per meter, compared to roughly 0.1 gigaelectron volts per meter possible with radio frequency cavities. However, the EUPRAXIA Consortium, which consists of researchers from 16 institutes in 5 European countries, aims to show that the technology can be used by industry and academia to carry out specific tasks. In a conceptual design report released at the end of October, but not yet formally announced, the consortium says that it intends to build plasma accelerators fed by both high-powered lasers and conventional electron accelerators in order to generate high-quality beams of electrons with energies between 1 and 5 gigaelectron volts. Those beams, it said, could be used in a range of applications, including medical imaging, positron generation, material testing, and above all, to power the compact free electron lasers. Let me drop for a second. Existing free electron lasers use either copper or superconducting cavities to accelerate electrons to high energies with magnets, then forcing the particles around sharp bends so that they emit exceptionally bright flashes of X-rays. But the world's leading device, located in Europe, the U.S., and Asia, are hundreds of yards, if not more than a mile long. The much higher gradients possible with plasma accelerators could potentially make free electron lasers small enough to fit in the grounds of a hospital, for example. Physicist Carsten Welsh with the University of Liverpool, who is EUPRAXIA's head of communications, adds that existing free electron lasers are heavily oversubscribed. If you had a facility that could produce a similar quality laser beam, but with a smaller footprint, it would be a direct gain, he said. In its report, the consortium puts forward several scenarios for the new facility, along with their associated costs. The most expensive option, $357 million, involves building laser-driven and electron-driven accelerators on separate sites, complete with a number of applications, as well as an extensive program of laser research and development. The construction of a single type of accelerator combined with the free electron laser, however, comes in at a paltry $76 million, if fed by electrons, and $84 million if a laser is used. The consortium explains that it originally intended to propose a design for a plasma accelerator facility independent of any site. In the end, however, it endorsed a specific location for the electron-driven accelerator, the Frascati National Laboratory outside Rome. Researchers there have already embarked on a program to build a plasma device that doubles the energy provided by advanced radio frequency cavities. Let me drop for a second. In contrast, the report lists 4 possible sites for a laser-driven accelerator. 2 of these are in Italy, the Frascati Lab and a branch of the National Optic Institute in Pisa, while the other is at the Eli Beamlines Laser Center near Prague in Czech Republic and the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire, United Kingdom. According to Welsh, if EUPRAXIA gets the go-ahead, it should be providing beams to users within 10 years. Given how long it will take to build and commission the accelerator, he says, that a site decision would need to be taken definitely in the next 5 years and probably in the next 2 or 3. As for using the facility to accelerate electrons for particle physics experiments, according to Welsh, the energies involved will be too low to make a significant discovery. At least for the initial 10-year time frame, these applications wouldn't be possible, he said. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. A woman's year year-long beauty regimen caused severe mercury poisoning and irreversible neurological damage, say her doctors in a recent case report published in the Center of Disease Control and Prevention this past month. The 47-year-old woman's ordeal was detailed in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, a clearinghouse for public health information collected by the CDC from state health departments and local doctors. According to the report, the Sacramento, California resident sought medical care earlier this July when her arms developed involuntary muscle spasms and became extremely weak. Over the next 2 weeks, she deteriorated further and was unable to walk, speak, and see normally, which led to her hospitalization. In the hospital, she experienced delirium, a state of serious mental confusion. 2 weeks into her hospitalization, blood tests showed that she had an incredibly high mercury level. Her blood contained more than 1,000 times the level of mercury compared to the average person. Interviews with her family soon after revealed that the Mexican-American woman had been using skin whitening cream brought back from Mexico for at least 7 years. Mercury has long been popular as an ingredient in whitening creams because it can also stop skin cells from producing melanin. But its toxicity eventually led countries across the world to ban or strictly restrict its use in cosmetic products, including the United States. Yet companies in Mexico, as well as many other countries, still routinely add mercury to their skin creams. Let me drop for a second. The woman's ordeal was all the more tragic, however, because her cream was found to have organic mercury rather than the inorganic mercury typically added to these products. Organic mercury is much more toxic to the human body in smaller dosages, especially to the brain, and victims are much less likely to recover once neurological symptoms have occurred. These symptoms, as in the woman's case, can take months to years of exposure to manifest themselves. This isn't to say skincare products made with inorganic mercury are safe either. They've been linked to kidney damage, skin rashes, scarring, as well as depression and psychosis. But inorganic mercury is easier to clear through chelation therapy, a technique to pull out toxic metals like both organic and inorganic mercury from the body. In this case, doctors began chelation as soon as they discovered mercury in her blood. But despite prolonged chelation therapy, the authors wrote, the woman isn't regaining the ability to talk, and she is unable to care for herself, requiring ongoing tube feeding for nutritional support. According to the authors, this is the first case of organic mercury poisoning linked to skin whitening creams ever documented, and the first case of poisoning tied to a particular form of organic mercury called methylmercury seen in the United States in nearly half a century. The original source of the organic mercury in the woman's skin cream is still unknown, the authors wrote, but California health officials are testing samples of other skin whitening creams for mercury. They're also investigating the case of a family member with likely exposure but less severe illness. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Those Chinese geneticists, they seem to be at it all over again. Welcome to our brave new world. By introducing a chemical cocktail to granulosa cells, researchers in good old China induced the cells to transform into functional oocytes, better known to us as egg cells, in mice. Once fertilized, these oocytes were then successfully able to produce healthy offspring, showing no differences from naturally bred mice. The chemical reprogramming method was published December 24th in the journal Cell Reports. Ovarian follicles are the basic functional unit of the ovary and consist of an oocyte, the immature egg, which is surrounded by granulosa cells. Besides being crucial to the development of follicles, studies have shown that granulosa cells possess plasticity and show stem cell-like properties. Quote, the thing about in vitro fertilization is that they only use the oocyte for the procedure, said senior author Lin Liu of the College of Life Sciences at Nankin University. After the egg retrieval, the granulosa cell in the follicles are discarded. It got us thinking, what if we could utilize those granulosa cells? Since every egg has thousands of granulosa cells surrounding it, we can induce them into pluripotent cells and turn these cells into their own oocytes. Aren't we killing two birds with one stone, he questioned. Granulosa cells tend to undergo cell death and differentiation once removed from the follicle. Lou and his team developed a chemical cocktail with a ROCK inhibitor and crotonic acid for creating chemically induced pluripotent stem cells from granulosa cells. The research team introduced the ROCK inhibitor to prevent cell death and promote proliferation. In combination with other important small chemicals, crotonic acid facilitates the induction of granulosa cells into germ-line competent pluripotent stem cells that exhibit pluripotency similar to embryonic stem cells. Let me drop for a sec. It's a surprising result, said Lou. The competency of induced pluripotent germline is usually lower than embryonic stem cells. Germline competency is crucial for germline cells to transfer genetic information to the next generation. The co-formulation of ROCK inhibitor and crotonic acid is not only more efficient, but the quality also increased, he said. Another cocktail of ROCK inhibitor and vitamin C is introduced to the germline competent pluripotent stem cells to improve the follicle development and induce meiosis. Meiosis is the process of a single cell becoming a sex cell, the egg. Germ cells and oocytes rejuvenated with granulosa cells exhibit high genomic stability and successfully produce offspring that show normal fertility. Quote, we can consistently manipulate the concentration and treatment time of these small chemicals, said Lou, compared to traditional stem cell-inducing methods such as transfection, which reprogram cells by introducing transcription factors to somatic cells. Chemical treatment provides higher controllability. The transfection method may have a higher risk of genetic instability. This is the first time that we turn granulosa cells into oocytes. It is a crucial and interesting work in development and reproductive biology, he said. But implementing this research to humans for mice still has a long way to go. I think it has a more prospect in preserving fertility and endocrine function than in treating infertility, he said. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next, I guess. The best way to avoid baldness is to stop hair from falling out in the first place. Now, researchers say a new hair growth discovery might help men keep their locks for a lifetime. The new insight involves a structure lying within the hair follicle. Quote, our major discovery is a previously unknown smooth muscle that surrounds hair follicles and is called the dermal sheath, explained lead researcher Dr. Michael Rendell. He's associate director of the Black Family Stem Cell Institute at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Rendell explained that in the life cycle of each human hair, a hair shaft is created by so-called dermal papilla cells. These specialized cells begin at the base of the growing hair follicle, but then move slowly upward towards stem cells that are found at the follicle's tip. These stem cells receive signals from the nearby dermal papilla cells to start the next growth phase and make a new hair shaft while the previous hair shaft is shed, the researchers explained in a Mount Sinai news release. However, sometimes this cell-to-cell partnership gets interrupted, and that could play a role in hair loss. One question that's long puzzled researchers is how the dermal papilla cells travel up towards the stem cells. Working with mice, they say, we found an answer for how it works by discovering that the dermal sheath surrounding the growing hair follicle is a smooth muscle whose function is to contract and push up the hair shaft and pull up the dermal papilla, Rendell said. Further experiments suggest that human hairs follow a similar mechanism, his team reported. Let me drop for a sec. And in the hair destruction phase of the hair growth cycle, the dermal sheath contracts, allowing the existing hair strand to fall out. This happens naturally in full heads of hair, but when it occurs too often, baldness can begin to set in. According to Rendell, this new insight into how the dermal sheath works could refocus research into hair loss. Quote, by blocking the newly discovered muscle and its contraction cannot cure baldness caused by these processes, he explained. Instead, blocking contraction and arresting the destruction phase of the cycle has the potential to retain the existing hair shaft that is otherwise lost when a new hair shaft is produced. Quote, this type of muscle cannot be controlled voluntarily. It is similar to the ones in blood vessels, Rendell said. But we can control it by drugs and can block contraction. That means men might someday have the treatment that simply allows them to maintain their head of hair that they have now instead of slowly losing it. Quote, we are excited about the possibility to develop methods for blocking sheep contraction, stopping follicle regression, and preventing the loss of existing hair below new hair that can grow, Rendell said. One dermatologist who knows about hair growth said that hair loss said the findings might offer new hope to follicly challenged men. The future